A kid named Alexander was born in the year 356 BC in the country of Macedonia, a kingdom which was on the fringes of the ancient Greek city-states of Athens and Sparta, a kingdom that was steeped in Greek culture. The dominant power of the world at the time of that boy's birth was Persia. That'd be Medo-Persia, to be exact. But Alexander's father had an idea about changing that. The boy Alexander's father happened to be the king of Macedonia. His name was Philip, and he wanted to end the era of Persian dominance. While Philip built up a powerful army and began making military advances, Alexander was being tutored by a guy named Aristotle. You might have heard of him. Aristotle taught Alexander about philosophy and medicine and scientific investigation. Alexander's father, Philip, taught him about war. When Philip was assassinated in 336 BC, 20-year-old Alexander was ready to take over his father's quest. Now, you can't conquer an empire as large as Persia's all at once. You've got to go bit by bit, and that's what Alexander did, dealing defeat after defeat to the Persian king Darius in his efforts to hold him off. Alexander started east, but then instead of going straight at the Persian capital cities, they had more than one, he turned south and he conquered Egypt first. And then a winter hit, and while he was waiting through the winter, he started a brand new city in Egypt that he vainly named Alexandria. Alexandria, a city that still thrives there today. In 331 BC, Alexander, who had begun to be called Alexander the Great due to all his successes, finally marched to take on King Darius directly. The two men and their armies faced off near the city of Nineveh, where Alexander's men won the day. Temporarily, Darius escaped up into Media, but the next year, Alexander marched there as well and completed the primary goal of his and his father's dream of conquest. He didn't stop there, of course. Alexander continued to expand what would become known as the Greek Empire over the next 7 years until suddenly, at age 33, he got sick and died. After Alexander's death, the empire that he had brought together was at first split between a son of his who was born just after he died and a half-brother of Alexander's. But soon both of those individuals had been murdered, and the empire was then divided into four different independent kingdoms, each ruled by one of the men who had been the most successful generals in Alexander's powerful army. And those four kingdoms then went on to basically just war against each other, battling for power and for territory. We are, as you know, in a sermon series on Daniel, a book in the Old Testament of our Bibles. And last week we moved into the second half of Daniel, which is primarily made up of prophecy. First half of Daniel largely contains stories, and we enjoyed going through those good stories. But now we're in a section of the book where, you know, we have to talk a little history, and we have to sit and think about the meaning of some of the symbols and the statements made in these prophetic writings. Our primary passage for today is going to be Daniel chapter 8, picking up where we left off last Sunday. However, we're also going to read / skim through some of Daniel chapter 11, and that's actually where I want us to start today. So if you would please grab a Bible now and find with me Daniel chapter 11. At the beginning of chapter 10, the text says that a vision came to Daniel. It says they're in the third year of Cyrus of Persia. So this is Daniel still living in the city of Babylon, but at the time of this vision, this was after the Medo-Persian Empire had come in and conquered Babylon. The Persians were now in control. The description of the vision begins in chapter 10, but the bulk of its content is found in chapter 11. And before we start reading it, I'll just tell you that the being who is delivering the prophecy to Daniel in chapter 11 most likely is the angel Gabriel, who we'll meet when we jump back into chapter 8 later on in the sermon. I want us to read the beginning of the of the prophecy in chapter 11, and then we'll skim through some more of it. I want you to get a sense of what's going on in this chapter. So, with your Bibles open, I will read for you now, starting with the second verse of chapter 11, and you can follow along as I do that. Here we go. So, the being, likely Gabriel, says to Daniel, "Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will arise in Persia after Cyrus, and then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will arise who will rule with great power and do as he pleases." And I'm just going to tell you here, that verse we just read is a prophecy of Alexander the Great. Now verse 4. "After he has arisen, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven." Referring there, of course, to the four independent kingdoms that the Empire of Greece was split into after Alexander's death. Next, it says, "It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others." Okay, so this is Daniel living at this time in the Persian Empire, but he just received a prophecy there of that empire's demise coming at the hands of a mighty king who will do as he pleases, but whose empire will be broken up after his death and parceled out to the four winds. It won't go to his descendants. This is a prophecy of Alexander the Great and the four generals who split up and took over his empire after him. And now we start skimming. The next 30 verses are further prophecies of what will happen between two of those four kingdoms ruled by Alexander's generals. I told you that these kingdoms basically spent their time warring against each other, battling for power and wealth. So let the skimming begin. Here's verse 5. It says, "The king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power." Skip to verse 7. "One from her family line will arise to take her place. He'll attack the forces of the king of the north and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious." Skip over to verse 12. "When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands. Yet he will not remain triumphant, for the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years, he will advance with a huge army fully equipped." And over to verse 17. Now, and by the way, the kings of the north and the kings of the south, they're changing over all of these verses, okay? This is not just one king of the north and one king of the south. This passage is actually covering quite a lot of time. Here's verse 17. "He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south, and he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom, but his plans will not succeed." I think you get the idea of what's going on in this chapter, right? Let's take a look at a visual aid now to help us cement this stuff.
"First three jumps right over to a mighty king that arose with great dominion. History confirms that this king is Alexander the Great from the Grecian Empire. It reads, "Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided towards the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others besides these." Now move to the conflicts between the king of the south and the king of the north, found from verse 5 right through to the rest of the chapter. Who are they? As already noted, after Alexander's death, his kingdom was divided among his four generals, namely Ptolemy, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Cassander. Ptolemy took Egypt, Libya, Arabia, and Palestine and the southern part. Seleucus took Syria and the eastern part. Lysimachus took Thrace, parts of Asia, and the northern part. And Cassander took Macedonia and the western part. It was out of this division that began two dynasties, namely the king of the south and the king of the north. The king of the south is undoubtedly the king of Egypt, which was obtained by Ptolemy and was ruled under a succession of kings known as the Ptolemies. The king of the north is the king of Syria, which was obtained by Seleucus and ruled under a succession of kings known as the Seleucidae. History shows us that Seleucus had won most of the territory belonging to the other two divisions of the Grecian Empire, that of Lysimachus and Cassander. The nation of Israel was caught right in the middle of the conflicts between Egypt and Syria, and was at times in the possession of the kings of Egypt, the king of the south, and sometimes of the kings of Syria, the king of the north. The reason that Daniel sees these as north and south was because Palestine was the central point of God's dealings on the earth, Syria being the north and Egypt being the south. Palestine became the battleground between these ongoing conflicts that arose out of the Grecian Empire. These titles, the King of the South and the King of the North, are therefore representative titles of a succession of kings and their empires. They are the Ptolemaic Empire and the Seleucid Empire, respectively.
Okay. Just about time to move into our central passage for today, Daniel chapter 8. But before you turn there, I will first have you grab your document or your chart that you should have found on or near your chair when you sat down today. And if you didn't get one, please find one. There should be something near to you. You're going to also need a pen, and I'm quite sure there each chair back has one of those. So let's take a look at that document or chart together. We were working with this chart last Sunday, and all of the fill-in-the-blanks that we did last week have now been printed for you on this new copy. You can see that we went through chapter 2 last Sunday morning, which told us of a dream that God gave to King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, a dream of a huge statue that had a head of gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, and feet partly of iron and partly of clay. In that dream, a rock appeared and struck the statue in its feet, causing the whole statue to collapse, and then that rock grew into a huge mountain. Nebuchadnezzar is the one who had the dream, but then God gave to Daniel the interpretation of it, which he then delivered to Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel said that each section of that statue represented successive empires. Other than the first one, the head of gold, which Daniel identified as Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian Empire, he didn't give the names of the later empires, but we know what they are now, and again, I'll explain how we know that as we go along through this series. The Babylonians would be taken over by the Medo-Persian Empire, the Medo portion in lowercase letters on our sheets, and the Persian part in uppercase letters, because the Persian nation that was part of that combo empire was definitely the stronger of its two members. The Medo-Persian Empire corresponded to the chest and arms of silver. The prophecy said that the Medo-Persian Empire would be defeated by the Greek Empire, something we heard about at the beginning of our sermon today. Greece is the belly and thighs of bronze. Rome later would best the Greek Empire. I had you leave blank the spot next to the feet, partly of iron and partly of clay. We'll cover that down the road. And finally, it also becomes clear that the rock that struck the statue was symbolic of the coming Messiah. And the mountain that the rock grew into represents the kingdom of God, the only kingdom on our sheet without an end date. Finally, we also worked through chapter 7 last Sunday. Chapter 7 told of a vision that was given directly to Daniel that communicated very similar things as the chapter 2 vision. There was a lion with eagle's wings that represented the empire of Babylonia. There was a bear with one side raised up, a raised up muscular side, representing the stronger Persia versus the weaker Media. Then came a leopard with four heads, and so on. All right, we're ready to start filling in the next column on our chart now. That would be the column labeled chapter 8, of course. So with your pen and your chart ready, you can turn now in your Bibles over to Daniel 8, verse 1. And I'll give you a second to flip from chapter 11 to chapter 8. Heading backwards in time. Here comes another vision given by God to Daniel. This is back when the Babylonians still were in charge of Babylon. And this one comes 2 years after the one we read in chapter 7 last week. Let's read it. This is chapter 8, verse 2, which says, "In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that had already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw myself in the citadel of Susa in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later. I watched the ram as it charged toward the west and the north and the south. No animal could stand against it, and none could rescue from its power. It did as it pleased and became great." Here is our first fill-in-the-blank for the day under the chapter 8 column, and next to the line that links up with the Medo-Persian Empire, rather than the Babylonian Empire, to the right of where it says bear with one side raised up. Right now, ram with one horn longer than the other. Ram with one horn longer than the other. And we know now why one horn was longer than the other, because again, Persia was the more powerful of the two countries formed that empire. The Medians probably would have had an inferiority complex after reading all these prophecies. So we have a powerful ram there, and we're on to verse 5. Daniel writes, "As I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between its eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. It came toward the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal and charged at it in a great rage. I saw it attack the ram furiously, striking the ram and shattering its two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against it. The goat knocked it to the ground and trampled on it, and none could rescue the ram from its power. The goat became very great, but at the height of its power, the large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven." You will have already figured out that this goat represents the Empire of Greece. So you can write in our column for today on the horizontal line that has Greece on it, write, "Goat with one horn replaced by four horns." Goat with one horn replaced by four horns. And why was the one horn replaced by four horns? Because the one horn is Alexander the Great, who was replaced by his four generals. Same reason that the leopard over in chapter 7 there had, in that column, had four heads. Well, this isn't the only thing going on top of this goat's head. Let's keep reading. Verse 9. "Out of one of the four horns came another horn, which started small but grew in power toward the south and toward the east and toward the beautiful land. It grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry hosts down to the earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. It took away the daily sacrifice from the Lord, and his sanctuary was thrown down. Because of rebellion, the Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground." And at this time, I have one more video to show you. Please don't be insulted by the age level that this video is intended for. Sometimes simpler is better. Here we go.
Once upon a time, over 2,000 years ago, in the land of Judea, there was a most holy ancient temple. In the land lived many Jews, religious people, who had special traditions and activities they honored year-round. They dressed a certain way, ate different kinds of foods, and worshiped one God in that most holy ancient temple. In that temple, there burned a menorah, a special candlestick with branches that represented God's glory and eternal light. The menorah was supposed to burn all the time, and it used a special pure oil to keep the flames fed. There was peace in this land, but then a king named Antiochus invaded and began to rule Judea. He was powerful and wicked, and many of his own subjects feared him. King Antiochus didn't like how the Jewish people lived. He did not want anyone in his kingdom to worship in traditional ways. He wanted everyone, Jews included, to dress how he did, eat the same foods as him, and worship the same gods and idols that he worshiped. The king sought out to stop Jewish customs everywhere. "It's time to end Jewish worship in the temple," King Antiochus announced. "No one is allowed to pray to God anymore." With swift orders and action, the king declared Jewish tradition against the law. He turned the holy temple into an unholy place and placed strange statues inside. Most people knew this was wrong, and everyone was scared. But many Jews agreed to go along with the king's plan to not make extra trouble and draw attention to themselves. Because if the king caught anyone disobeying his new laws, they could be killed. After all, it would be impossible to fight and win against such a powerful king. But a priest named Mattathias thought differently. He refused to obey the king's orders. Mattathias was brave, and so was his son, Judah, and many other Jewish men who wanted to free the land. This brave group was called the Maccabees, which means hammers. They believed that miracles could happen thanks to God. They were determined to restore their temple. The Maccabees were a small group compared to the king's massive army, but they were mighty. They had determination, perseverance, and faith to fight the king's wrongful ways with sword, strength, and spirit, day and night for months and years. They grew weary, but remembered their purpose and forged on. Against all odds, the Maccabees won the war against the king. It was a miracle. Freedom to worship was restored. The first thing the Maccabees did was return to their most holy temple. But when they saw what King Antiochus did to it, they were heartsick. It wasn't the beautiful temple they remembered. It was a mess with idols and altars to false gods. A most troubling discovery for the Maccabees was when they found their menorah. It had been cast aside, and almost all the oil that would allow it to burn bright once again was gone. There was only enough left for the menorah to burn for one day, and it would take 8 days to make more oil. The Maccabees got straight to work. They immediately discarded all the altars and idols the king had set up in their holy place. Judah and his men cleansed the temple with great care and restored Jewish traditions inside. 8 days later, when more oil was finally ready, the men were shocked to find the menorah still burning with light. How could this be? The oil that should have lasted only one day lasted eight. It was a miracle, a sign from God. On that day, the Maccabees rededicated the temple to God for the Jewish people. This triumphant occasion is now celebrated as Hanukkah, a time when religious freedom conquered all. And to this day, Jewish people all over the world celebrate this victory by lighting a menorah over 8 nights to remember that miracles can come true.
All right, so the story behind Hanukkah. It's a true story, although it's not in our Bibles. Kind of wish it was, actually. So yeah, the Maccabees, with the help of God, led a somewhat shocking, successful revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes and his armies. Who was Antiochus Epiphanes? Well, he was one of the kings of the north that our previous video talked about. One in the line of the Seleucid kings of Syria, and he is known as being one of the cruelest rulers the world has ever seen. And I'll tell you, that's saying something. Antiochus wasn't supposed to become a king of the north. He wasn't in line to become king, but when the king that he served under died and left an infant son to the throne, Antiochus proclaimed himself the boy's co-regent, and he, yep, you guessed it, a few years later he had arranged for that boy to be murdered, and Antiochus took the throne. Antiochus had two desires. One was to expand his territory, and the other was to force everyone in his territory to follow Greek customs and culture and worship Greek gods. He ran into a lot of roadblocks in his attempts to expand his empire, which made him frustrated. And in regards to forcing everyone to assimilate into Greek culture and religion, there was one thorn in his side. That would be the Jewish people. Israel was part of his territory, and Antiochus had ordered that any Jew caught reading the Torah, so that's the first five books of our Old Testament, would be put to death. He didn't allow them to observe the Sabbath or to follow God's command to circumcise their baby boys. While many Jews sought to avoid death by going along with his commands, so that would be the rebellion against God mentioned in the prophecy, there were also many Jews who resisted. So the Jews became another source of frustration for Antiochus. Those two areas of frustration intertwined in the year 168 BC when Antiochus was once again foiled in an attempt to conquer Egypt, and then on his way back home, he decided to take out all of his rage on Israel. The New World Encyclopedia says that Antiochus marched to Jerusalem, slew the high priest along with many others, and dedicated the Israelite temple to Zeus, erecting an image of Zeus in his own likeness on the altar. And according to some sources, he also sacrificed a pig, that'd be an unclean animal for the Jews, in the temple. The normal sacrifices that the temple made to God of Israel were no longer allowed. And then you saw how that whole scene played out. After all that, in the video. So look back at verse 9 of chapter 8 with me, now that we have the story of Antiochus Epiphanes in our heads. And let's read that again. Verse 9, out of one of the four horns came another horn. The four horns were the four kingdoms that the Greek Empire had been split into. And out of one of those horns, the Seleucid horn of Syria, came another horn, and this would be Antiochus Epiphanes. I'll start verse 9 again and keep reading this time. Out of one of the four horns came another horn, which started small but grew in power toward the south and toward the east and toward the beautiful land being Israel. It grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry hosts down to the earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. It took away the daily sacrifice from the Lord, and his sanctuary was thrown down. Because of rebellion, the Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. This is a prophecy of one of the, well, probably the worst of the kings of the north, Antiochus Epiphanes. And you can see the image I put on your charts there of the goat, which at that point had lost its original one horn. And you can see the four horns there, and then the little horn growing out of one of those four horns. And again, this week, the horn in the picture that I've added onto your chart has a face attached to it, and that's the face of Antiochus Epiphanes. Let's read the rest of chapter 8 now. We left off at verse 13. Here it is. Then Daniel said, I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to him, how long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled, the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, the surrender of the sanctuary, and the trampling underfoot of the Lord's people? And he said to me, it will take 2,300 evenings and mornings, and then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated. I don't have time to go into detail on this one, but you saw in the video that the temple was eventually restored and reconsecrated. And there are actually a couple of different ways that this prophecy of 2,300 evenings and mornings can fit into the time frame from when the temple was defiled by Antiochus until its reconsecration. Verse 15. While I, Daniel, was watching the vision and trying to understand it, there before me stood one who looked like a man. And I heard a man's voice from the Ulai calling, Gabriel, tell this man the meaning of the vision. So we're introduced to the angel Gabriel. As he came near the place where I was standing, I was terrified and fell prostrate. Son of man, Gabriel said, and we're not talking about the Messiah, son of man here. This is Daniel, son of a man. Gabriel said to me, understand that the vision concerns the time of the end. While he was speaking to me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. He touched me and raised me to my feet. He said, I'm going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath, because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. The two-horned ram that you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat is the king of Greece. So here you go. This is how we know some of the empires on our sheet. Right? Because here God gave us two of the names right there. Two-horned ram represents the kings of Media and Persia. Shaggy goat is the king of Greece. And the large horn between its eyes is the first king. The four horns that replace the one that was broken off represent four kingdoms that will emerge from his nation, but they'll not have the same power. In the latter part of their reign, when rebels have become completely wicked, a fierce-looking king, a master of intrigue, will arise. He will become very strong, but not by his own power. He will cause astounding devastation and will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy those who are mighty, the holy people. He will cause deceit to prosper, and he will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the prince of princes. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. The vision of the evenings and mornings that has been given to you is true, but seal up the vision, for it concerns the distant future. I, Daniel, was worn out. I lay exhausted for several days, and then I got up and went about the king's business. I was appalled by the vision. It was beyond understanding. Now, it sure looks like Gabriel is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes in verses 23 and forward there, but is he? He opened that later section in verse 19 saying he was going to be talking about the appointed time of the end. The king he talks about in those later verses there was going to take a stand against the prince of princes. And this king would be destroyed, but not by human power, verse 25 said. So is he talking about Antiochus? I think he is talking about Antiochus there, but I think he is also talking about somebody else. I'm going to have you flip back to chapter 11. If you would, go to chapter 11, verse 21. Daniel 11, verse 21. The verse right before verse 21 was talking about one of the kings of the north. And then in verse 21, it says, that king will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. This would be Antiochus. Wasn't supposed to be a king. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he'll seize it through intrigue. And for the sake of time, skip over to verse 29, where it says, at the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he'll lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. Sound familiar? He'll return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. That is what the Jews called Antiochus's act of setting up the statue of Zeus in the temple. The abomination that causes desolation. With flattery, he'll corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Okay, he's talking about Antiochus there, right? Or is he? Skip to verse 36. It says, That king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his ancestors or for the one desired by women. And commentators believe the one desired by women is the Messiah. That's okay, right? Nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Okay, so he's going to say unheard of things against God. He'll be successful until the time of wrath. So, were you here last week? Who does this make you think of? Perhaps the other horn on our sheets with mouth and eyes that came up from the head of the fourth beast. And note that this is not the same horn as the one we've been talking about today, because today's horn was on the head of the goat, which is part of the Empire of Greece, and the one last week was on the head of the fourth beast, the one representing Rome. But who did we say that that horn picture was of? The Antichrist. The future Antichrist. That's what we said about that other little picture last week. So Gabriel's descriptions of Antiochus are about Antiochus, but they sometimes sound like he's talking about somebody else. Well, to finish this thought off, I need to take you to one more passage, but this time it's a New Testament passage, and this is going to be Jesus speaking. Matthew 24, this one will be on the screen for you. Matthew 24, verse 3 says, "As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. 'Tell us,' they said, 'what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?' Jesus answered, 'Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. You'll hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you're not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Because of the increase in wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." And then take a look at this. Verse 15, "So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the housetop go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get their cloak. For then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he'll send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds," and so on. Okay, so the prophecy of an abomination that causes desolation in Daniel was fulfilled in the year 168 B.C. in the person of Antiochus Epiphanes and what he did to the temple. So that's 168 B.C. as in before Christ. But now we're reading the words of Christ. And he is saying here that there is still another abomination of desolation that will be set up in the temple, and it will be a sure sign of the end times. So this one hasn't happened yet. Another abomination is coming. Does that mean that another Antiochus is coming? So many questions, and once again, we are out of time. Before I can answer them. And actually, I didn't even answer most of the questions that we had at the end of last week's sermon that I said I was going to answer today. Sorry about that. All in due time, we'll get there. I'll do my best for you. These prophecy sections are not easy to work through. I know that. I hope you're hanging in there. But we continue week by week to see how God has been at work throughout history, how he has maintained movement toward his good goals of salvation and restoration despite the incredibly evil behaviors of human beings along the way. Human choices for evil, they can and do cause so much pain and suffering. Our choices can create detours and outcomes that shouldn't have been, but human beings will not be able to thwart God's ultimate plan for the earth. He's been working behind the scenes, hasn't he? In the Babylonian age, in the Persian age, throughout the warring of the kings of the north and the south, and even back then, he knew of things that are still yet to come, and he's given us glimpses of them. God is in control, and we can trust him. More to come as our series on Daniel unfolds.